Welcome back again to Red Star Radio. This one is a special one because it's a two-for-one episode. You get a discussion on a subject and you get an interview as well. And the interview in the latter part of the episode is going to be one we recorded last week with a Dr. Martin Kulldorff, who's a critic of the lockdown so-called health policy. So we had an interesting half hour or so long discussion with him, so that's going to be the back half of the program. But in the front half of the program, we thought we'd dedicate it purely to the discussion of Bill Gates's divorce, obviously the most important subject of the day. We both have strong opinions on it. What does it say about what the billionaire class is like consuming these days? What wives are they consuming? Is Bill Gates even a man or a creature, a lizard creature in a human, and a rough approximation of a human costume? All these things and more will be on the menu for today. But seriously, Layla, what are we actually discussing?
Well, we're going to be talking about conspiracy theories and Marxism and why you and I are both not on board with the conspiracy theory outlook in terms of understanding society. Conspiracy theories definitely exist, but they are not the motor of history.
Yeah. Conspiracies happen all the time, but they're a product of various different forces and not the thing that's the motor force of history.
Oh, but Alex, what do you think of Bill Gates's divorce? I'm very confused about it, actually.
Are you confused? What's confusing?
So Bill Gates leaves his wife of 30 years, and I was expecting there to be a hot young mistress waiting to take his ex-wife's place. But in fact, it's quite a plain-looking older woman. So what's going on? Like, what do men want? Can you clarify that? I get more and more confused every single day.
I think the mistake in your analysis there is assuming that Bill Gates is human. And a man like any other, whereas in actual fact he is, as Alex Jones said, just a man, a lizard in a man costume. But seriously, I have no idea what the fuck that guy's on to. Maybe he's just looking. Maybe he's married his lawyer. I don't know. maybe this is just all in preparation for some sort of lawsuit from an Epstein victim which is coming his way. Because old Bill was very friendly with Jeffrey. Mm. So who knows? Maybe he just wants somebody who can respond quickly to legal notices, or somebody who can copyright the various vaccines that he's trying to maintain exclusive rights over at the moment.
It could.
Maybe she's a patent lawyer.
It could be that he just thought, you know, I'm always on the phone with my lawyer. I'm always, you know, having to schedule these phone calls. But if we're married, we could just have these discussions a lot more easily.
Yeah, because we can just discuss it over dinner.
Exactly, yeah. Although, that's a pessimistic interpretation, Alex. But might it be, though, that true affection and true compatibility cannot be bought? And Bill Gates realized that?
Well, I see it in the same way, like when Bezos got divorced and all that happened, and it was just revealed that these guys are just very lame.
Okay, that's not nice, Alex.
They are very lame. I mean, they make all this money, and like they're held up by like various different bourgeois journalists as like the masters of the universe, and then you look at them, and they're actually like pretty goofy, lame guys who basically got to be billionaires by being good at one particular thing, and the one particular thing that Jeff Bezos was good at was having a very rich father, and the one particular thing that Bill Gates was very good at was copywriting other people's inventions in the 70s to then claim that they were his.
How does he
and
do
that
it?
Was like, well, how does he make his money? And but that's what I mean. Like, you look into them, and actually, they're fairly lame. They're like, they showed some initiative at like in Gates's case, like he was around, I think it was like the computer hobbyist scene in like California in the 70s, and then he was able to like jump in quickly and copyright things and claim that he'd then invented it. then that's where like the Microsoft billions came, trillions or however many, how whatever figure it is comes from. The fact that he was just quicker off the market stealing other people's work. And Bezos realized that, hey, there's this thing called the internet. Maybe people will order things online through it.
Yeah, well,
hey, Dad, lend me the money. Yeah, barely even a gamble. But unlike like the comedian Tim Dillon makes this like quite funny observation that the like all the billionaires now are just these lame nerds who like spend all their time like now not even creating anything but just like thinking up ways in which they can engage their like very nerdy hobbies. So like even trillionaires now are like just lame. This is all a product of capitalist decay.
Yeah. So I guess they're just regular dudes. Maybe they
just regular nerds. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. Well, I'm still confused about what men want. So for the many men that listen to this podcast, please DM me. Explain to me what men want.
You may regret saying
actually,
that.
Actually, yes. Don't DM me. But
do you want me to edit that out?
Yes. that out. Yeah, but yeah, that was an interesting. Always interesting to see the lifestyles of the rich and famous, I guess.
Yes, they make. It's like the Great Gatsby, in that fundamentally what you realize when you read it is that Gatsby's fucking boring.
Yeah, that's actually very true. That's a very good observation. Yeah, yeah. So I guess we shouldn't really feel bad about our maybe lackluster. I mean, not you and I. We have a brilliant podcast.
Yeah, growing every day.
So our lives are very exciting, but most people's lives are rather regular and lackluster. And, you know,
and it's no different than most. So is the rich.
Exactly. So is the rich. So.
Yeah. They're either like, you know, just like, it's just like the Great Gatsby. They're either like bland voids in the case of Gatsby, who's obsessed with an equally bland and vapid woman who's married to just this guy who's an asshole. And that's like, that is a very accurate representation of like the life and lifestyles of the rich and famous, like vapidity and just scumbaggery. Mm. And that's all it is.
True love, huh?
It really is, you know.
It's a rare thing under capitalism, I'd say. But
It is. But you know, talking of Bill Gates, it's a good segue into into the conspiracy theory discussion, which is Bill Gates a man or a lizard? Is Alex Jones right? These are all interesting questions. We've already answered that, really, which is he's a very boring man who's actually quite mundane.
Yes. I think it's interesting to talk about conspiracies before we play the interview with Dr. Koldorf, because in today's intellectual environment, I noticed that you essentially have two camps of people. You have, and they're all liberals, of course. You have liberals who will kind of join with the ascendant faction of the bourgeoisie and pretty much take everything they say at their word and reinforce.
Often hysterically so.
Often hysterically so. So for them, the only conspiracy are people who are denying what the bourgeoisie is saying. So those are the conspiracy theorists. But then you have people who are critically minded, who are principled, who are, you know, more within the tradition of classical liberalism. And from that camp, we've observed a lot of actually quite courageous bourgeois scientists and doctors and stuff stand up for truth and justice during this pandemic. Of course, Dr. Koldorf is definitely included in the courageous and brave camp. But I find that a lot of them, not everyone, of course, but a lot of them kind of are seeing the disintegration of and the attacks against empirical reality. And there's no way to understand it, really. Like, why is this happening exactly? And so I've noticed a lot of doctors in Ontario, for instance, have not Dr. Koldorf, but like a lot of doctors in Ontario, for instance, and scientists in Ontario, because they're not understanding how it's possible that so much propaganda and so much lying and so much, you know, just oppression is being conducted except through the lens of conspiracy. And so they fall back on things like the Great Reset conspiracy, or they'll fall back on like conspiracies about like the advent of an authoritarian Canadian state coming and things like that. But really, the explanation is much more simple, much more banal. So go ahead. What do you think, Alex?
Well, the other big one that you see on like the bourgeois right is the idea that it's all China.
Yes.
The Chinese are essentially seeding this everywhere to inspire a global takeover, whereby like the bourgeois politicians will somehow just all convert to using Chinese methods. Typical of this is an article that just popped up on my Twitter feed today. It's in The Spectator, which is like this bourgeois right-wing journal in Britain. And it's by a Scottish historian who I despise his work. It's this guy called Niall Ferguson. Have you heard of him?
Of course. Of course I've heard of that criminal.
Well, he's just a boring neoconservative, basically. But he's written this like quite ludicrous article today about how the West is falling for the Chinese model.
Mm.
And we'll cover more of this when we get to like next week. What we'll be doing for the Patreon episode will be on like the reforms of the Deng Xiaoping era. But like this is a thing that like the bourgeois right are now like going on about endlessly, how like China's taking over and the politicians are imitating China. Whereas in actual fact, what is happening and what the bourgeois right can't understand is that after like, because they took seriously the whole like Reagan and Thatcher revolution thing, and they can't understand why the state keeps getting bigger and why it keeps spending more money and why it keeps assuming more functions.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this also with like libertarians like being baffled and enraged by the fact that the Federal Reserve keeps doing quantitative easing and stuff like that. And they can't understand it. Whereas, like, you need an understanding based around, like, Lenin's concept of imperialism to understand why the capitalist state is acting as it is. So you see these bourgeois rightists thinking it's all this Chinese conspiracy. Because if you don't have a materialist understanding of the way that these things work out, then you, especially if you're from the bourgeois class or the petty bourgeoisie, and you think that the liberal model of society or the bourgeois liberal model of society is admirable and is something that is positive and should be defended, then, and you don't take a proletarian perspective, then you're going to see like this thing distorting and running away with itself into a sort of a series of irrational events as something which is a perversion, a distortion brought about by an evil outside agent,
mm-hmm.
rather than the logical irrational outgrowth of a system based on, well, large amounts of fictitious capital and ever-increasing state management of a crumbling capitalist economy.
Yes, indeed. I think the roots of this really lie in the idealist versus materialist conception of history, which of course Marx perfected. I think most bourgeois historians like will kind of mix the two, but they fundamentally kind of fall back to the idealist conception, which is the idea that ideas are the driving force of history. And so when you have that idea, when you have this conception that ideas are the driving force of history, then it makes it possible for history to be constructed and move forward by a small group of men, conniving behind closed doors in a smoke-filled room. Then it makes sense. But when you realize that actually, as Marx puts it, you can read it in the chapter one, for instance, of German ideology, quote, "From this it follows that the transformation of history into world history is not indeed a mere abstract act on the part of the, quote, self-consciousness, the world spirit of or of any other metaphysical specter, but a quite material, empirically verifiable act, an act the proof of which every individual furnishes as he comes and goes, eats, drinks, and clothes himself. So essentially Marx is saying that history is merely the sum of human activities. It is not the sum. It is not the result of ideas pushing through this, what Hegel says is spirit, pushing spirit through history and creating and driving human history forward. It's actually just the sum of human activities, material and social relations. So there's nothing mysterious about it, really. Like, there's no conspiracy needed. Although we see the results of this, and it seems quite conspiratorial, because it seems like there's some kind of rhyme or reason, a human rhyme or reason that's going on in this time, especially because we live in a time basically of pure bourgeois politics. So bourgeois politics is entirely driven by market imperatives. And so things do seem to coalesce in a way that seem conspiratorial. Like, different governments across the world will, you know, for instance, deploy very similar propaganda, have very similar policies. They seem to all know one another and things like that. But this is a direct result of the fact that they're all directly driven by market imperatives. So there's a material root to all of this. It's just because they're all driven by the same market imperatives, like competitive pressures everywhere. So that's why they seem so similar. It's not because there's a conspiracy, it's because they're all driven by the same motivations.
Yeah, this is all the same class interests at play, and it also is reflected from the old Adam Smith quote about the invisible hand at work. And Smith's point in the Wealth of Nations, and where the quote comes from, which is the theory of moral sentiments, is that it doesn't matter how greedy, selfish, grasping, or even criminal that the entrepreneur is, because the invisible hand of the market, the invisible hand that runs capitalism, tends towards making their activities in the for the betterment of humankind, thereby increasing the amount of wealth in a society, etc.
Mm-hmm.
That is true to an extent, and to the limited extent that the development of capitalism does take society forward. But as we covered in our episode on the manifesto, there's always a contradiction there, and that civilizing influence of capitalism always runs into contradictions. And the contradiction at work in the invisible hand is, yes, it leads all capitalists towards a similar end, but what it also does by disadvantaging in many ways the proletariat, who of course exploit it, and whose exploitation produces this wealth. But what that invisible hand actually represents is the interests of the bourgeoisie always moving towards a similar direction. So as you were saying, it can look as if these people are engaged in some sort of conspiracy, but they're being guided by their class interests towards a similar end. And sometimes that end is appalling for the majority of people, which is one of the contradictions in Smith's theory.
Yes.
It's not for the betterment of humankind as a whole, but it is for the betterment of the bourgeoisie as a whole, or at least the dominant sections of it, which is, along with a lot of the other bourgeois theorists of the Enlightenment, when they talked about humanity or mankind, what they mean is their class.
Yes.
Because they see their class as the universal subject.
Yes.
So their class is guided towards certain aims and ends, which can be revolting for most of us, but which, for their class, does very well. And this, the world that this creates, can look to be, for most people who are subjected to this world, something which is, of course, profoundly alienating, disturbing, and often cruel. And so the natural response of, like, thinking beings, which all human beings are, is to look for explanations. And when there isn't any, of course, the dominant ideas of the epoch are the dominant ideas of the ruling class. And so people fall back onto, like, liberal, individualistic, yeah, bourgeois liberal explanations for things.
Exactly.
And don't see that sort of wider, that wider picture of class interest at work through the invisible hand of the capitalist class, basically guiding their interests.
I think people have this because people are rational beings, and they're very seldom respected as such, actually, in our modern times. Like, people are not respected as people who can make their own decisions and understand information and come to right conclusions. But people are fundamentally rational. And so they're seeing the world, people who are, you know, enabled to maybe, like, so people who are, who have the material conditions to perhaps put themselves apart from the productive process. So like doctors, for instance, or professors and things like that, they're able to kind of observe what's going on. And they're just like, this is so irrational, except if there is some kind of a conspiracy. So they need to see the world as rationally organized because they themselves are rational. And so, but in fact, you have to understand that actually, yes, you're correct. Like, the world is run on an irrational basis from the perspective of the proletariat, but from the bourgeois perspective, everything that's going on is extremely rational. It's extremely rational because the only goal of capitalism is to generate profit and to continuously generate more and more profit. And so I think that if you lack this view, this class view of the world, it's very difficult to reconcile the human rationality from your point of view with the irrationality we observe all the time all around us. And that's why people have to resort to conspiracy theories, because it gives some kind of reason, rhyme and reason to what's going on. And I think also because the results of capitalism are so devastating to so many millions of people. People's lives are, you know, for instance, when I was reading about the vaccines for our last episode on COVID, I was reading about the results of the quickly manufactured swine flu vaccine, which was another manufactured pandemic around 10 years ago. And although the vaccine did not have adverse results for most people, one out of 10,000 people would have things like narcolepsy or like another kind of severe outcome. So that's very few people, like it's a very small chance, but nonetheless, that did result in thousands of people having their lives ruined. And so you're just like, you want to understand, you want to think that all this suffering has some kind of reason behind it. Like, at least someone's consciously trying to get you, at least. Like, that makes it a little better. And it's difficult to accept that actually the suffering from the perspective of the proletariat is completely irrational. And it's only rational from one person's perspective. And it's only rational because they're driven by the material need to continue to constantly create more value, a surplus value, in order to maintain capitalist domination. So I think it's difficult to accept. I find it very difficult to accept. But then when you have Marxism and when you have communism, then it doesn't let you wallow too long, because then you understand what needs to be done. And it's a politics of action. Wherein the conspiratorial view of things is because it's liberal and because it's petty bourgeois, is a politics of despair, because you can't really do anything about a small room of rich men conniving behind closed doors in a smoke-filled room, can you? But you can definitely do something about the fact that one tiny class of people own the means of production and an enormous class of people do not. That's something you can do something about.
Yeah, and the other thing that is often talked about is like the idea that these things that go on, whether it be it COVID or the Iraq war or any of the other big historical events of the last 20 years, the idea that somehow the truth is hidden by these tiny cabals. Now, I remember going back to the Iraq war, there was a conspiracy there. It was a conspiracy to lie about the reason, the threat, so-called, that Iraq posed to anybody, and to manufacture a case for invading it. But the thing is, the lies they were telling were appallingly constructed and easily disproved. Now, and the truth was very readily available for you if you knew how to dig a little bit. The problem wasn't that we didn't have the truth.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that we lacked the political means to actually do anything to stop what was going on. That was the problem. It wasn't that the reality was hidden from everybody. Everybody who got involved, even to the slightest degree, with the anti-war movement knew the truth of it. Even people who were like just tangentially watching events unfold knew that Blair was lying, and knew that it was had an instinct that he was talking a bunch of shit. And the problem was that there was, because the movement against the war was organized on the basis of liberalism, It was organized on the basis of the idea that if we could just, you know, get this number of people in the streets at this time and write to this many MPs and, you know, do this, that and the other and run along the rules of like polite bourgeois opposition, then somehow things would be okay. Well, of course, because the ruling class had decided in Britain that it was in their interests to invade, destroy and loot the Iraqi nation, then of course that was never going to be work. What we lacked was a real proletarian force that could stop the capitalist war machine in its tracks. And the only way we were ever going to do that is by engaging in like mass strike action to literally shut down the country and stop them moving the army.
Yeah.
That was the only way it was going to stop. And there was, because we didn't have that, people then started to look around to say, well, why did this go ahead? We had all these people. We had this and that and the other. Because everybody was still abiding by like the supposed rules of bourgeois politics, which Blair tore up and threw in the bin because it was in the ruling class's interest to do so. So it's not that we don't have the truth. It's not that the truth isn't available, be it on Iraq. Like the truth about COVID was available quite easily if you just knew how to dig. The problem in all these circumstances is that there isn't a proletarian political force that can make a real difference.
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep trying to play in the bourgeois game, you will keep losing, and then people will look for explanations within, again, bourgeois thought as to why they lost.
Mm-hmm.
And then come back to conspiracy theories again, often.
Yes, and I think people don't realize like how stupid these people actually are. Like,
yeah, how stupid the ruling class
are. They're really stupid. And the petty bourgeois are even stupider. Like, I never realized this until I had to interact with a lot of scientists and doctors and stuff like that. And actually, like, people like Dr. Kohldorf, I would say, are in the minority. People who are actually critically, who are critical thinkers, who will be honest with what they're seeing, will be honest scientists. It's actually extremely rare to find. And most scientists, like, they have like a tendency towards group thinking. They're very susceptible to group pressures. They're just petty bourgeois. Like, so they
just like the rest of their class.
Exactly.
Really.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and they actually do believe everything they say. There's no conspiracy needed at all. Like, they don't need to be, there's not even a need for like harsh coercion. Just a little bit of social pressure is enough for these people to abandon the scientific method. And that's what happened during this pandemic. So it was really, the bourgeoisie, I think bourgeois people are a little smarter, like definitely less hysterical. But they definitely go through phases of higher irrationality. So right now given the fact that we have these immense fictitious capital bubbles, they're extremely irrational. And so they don't really think straight either. Like, they're just not hysterical about it. And they don't typically put themselves out there. They use the petty bourgeoisie to be the face of their propaganda and their policies and stuff, mostly. So they seem a little bit more calm and put together, but they're irrational as well. And we'll see as things get, the fictitious bubbles get bigger and bigger, you're gonna see them acting even more erratically. Like, they're gonna be, you know, raising interest rates dramatically soon, I believe, for instance.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So yeah,
keep stay tuned to the channel for more on that.
I can't wait, Alex. yeah. So like, there's not really. I think that conspiracies definitely do exist. Like, there's definitely instances throughout human history where small groups of politicians have come together and have planned out a conspiracy and like deployed it. But the root of it is not some people's bad ideas. Like, the root of them, of these things, are material. They're material forces, and therefore, what we're seeing, the ideological, it's just the ideological expression of that. It's not the driving force of what's going on. The conspiracy is the symptom. It's not the disease. And therefore, you cannot address the conspiracy by, you know, kind of unveiling it or exposing it and showing the masses that they've been like, wake up, sheeple. Like, you're not going to fix the conspiracy by doing that. You're going to fix the conspiracy by building working class power, increasing the participation of the working class within the within bourgeois politics through that power, and therefore injecting more rationality into our system. And then, of course, the only real solution to all of this, because of course that will be a cyclical thing, is communist revolution. So it's not the most difficult thing in the world, but it's not hard to understand, and it's clarifying as well.
Yeah, and the point to bear in mind about the propaganda systems is that the propaganda systems these days, now that they've comprehensively pushed the working class out of the bourgeois political sphere, even from the limited gains that the working class had made towards the middle period of the last century, propaganda these days is designed to convince the petty bourgeoisie, principally.
Yes.
Because those are the people who are given their politics as the theatre, and therefore the propaganda is designed to keep them in a state of frenzied hysteria when the bourgeoisie wants to get something done. And that's what we've noticed in the past year. But it's also, given that the petty bourgeoisie, as Trotsky argued, acts as the enforcement arm of the bourgeoisie. They're the ones that act as their for masses when they need them, to be mobilized when they need them. So they need to be kept primed in a state ready to get hysterical at a moment's notice. And that's what the bourgeoisie directs its propaganda at the petty bourgeoisie. It's often created by other members of the petty bourgeoisie, so you end up with all of them in this self-reinforcing circle of absolute hysteria and madness, where, like, all truth has been abandoned, and they're all just in sort of some one horrendous circle of hysteria.
Yeah.
And if you look at everything in the last year, that certainly explains a lot.
And it's really sad to see, because for the members the principled members of the bourgeois, even individual bourgeois scientists and petty bourgeois people, for those of which have principles, or just kind of they have integrity as people, as human beings, and they're like, you know what, I'm not going to participate in this, like, this is the truth, like, here's the truth. And then, but you're in a situation where there's no revolutionary party, there's no revolutionary movement at all, and so those kinds of people, like, they don't have anywhere to turn except for the conspiratorial side. Those are the only people who are willing to hear them out, to give them a platform, to help them find other people. So it's really tragic, because that further marginalizes the petty bourgeois members who have integrity and who are telling the truth. Yeah. And so it's like a self-reinforcing loop in more than one way. And the way in which a Leninist party, for instance, could help with this situation is to break out of that, of these constraints, of these bourgeois constraints, to knowledge generation, and offer a space that is supported by the proletariat, and that is driven to serve the proletariat, and therefore driven to serve objective reality. And that kind of space could receive these doctors and scientists and give them support to uncover the truth and help people understand the world, and, you know, further enhance their ability to do that through dialectics, which is something that is lacking in liberal science writ large. So I think it's unfortunate. It's really hard to see, because, like, you have people who are so brave and courageous, and they immediately get smeared as, like, conspiracy theorists and stuff. And it's, like, really unfair, unfortunately. But, like, and then, like, the truth gets further marginalized as a result. So, yeah. But anyways, I think it really makes me admire these people even more, because it's probably one of the most difficult times in the modern era to be truthful. And if you're, especially coming from that class, it's like, it's even harder, but they do it anyways. So much love and respect.
Yeah. Credit to those who defied the conventional wisdom and the hysteria of their own class.
Yes.
Not an easy thing to do.
No.
So, I think that ties this part of the discussion in a rather neat bow at the end of it. So basically, if you want truth to triumph, you need communism. There you go.
Well, it's true.
it happens to be very, very true. Without the elevating the working class into being the ruling class, we're just going to be keep being subjected to the irrationality of the ruling class justified through the hysteria of the middle class.
Yeah, and I think also, though, like... you can't derive truth from false premises entirely, right? Like, you can derive some stuff, but you can't derive the truth, right? So,
just like you can't build a lasting wealthy society off of fictitious capital.
Exactly. Yes. That's a really great way of putting it. You know, if your premises are liberal, for instance, like your premises are that the individual exists a priori society, that is a false premise. And so the science that you will derive from that basis will not be entirely true. Like, I think it can still derive some truth, but it's limited and it's separated from like the matter in motion, you know? So like we're not going to be able to do good science. We're not going to be able to do good knowledge generation writ large without starting from the appropriate premises, which is that, number one, human beings are social beings who are embedded within a social sphere, and you know, the concept of an individual is therefore quite dialectical. Anyways, like, we can go on and on with this forever, but yeah, I think it's very true actually that, yeah, we can't really get to the truth without communism. The best we can do is use dialectics to cobble together a view of objective reality the best we can, and use that to inform the proletariat and how to gain power. That thing, that's what we can do under capitalism, and that's what the Leninist Party, for instance, should be doing if it existed.
Which is why we must build towards that point of actually having one.
Yeah.
Because we don't at the moment, not anywhere. So, and I think that's a good point to leave that part of the discussion. And then next thing you'll hear will be our interview with Dr. Martin Kulldorff, who, again, we thanked him in the interview, but thanks to him again for agreeing to come on and giving an illuminating interview on the state of science in general and some of the things around COVID lockdowns, etc.
Yeah.
So thanks everybody for listening, and we'll be talking to you again soon.
Talk to you soon. We're speaking with Dr. Martin Kulldorff, who is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a biostatistician and epidemiologist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's one of the three authors of the Great Barrington Declaration. He recently co-authored, quote, "Lockdown proponents can't escape the blame for the biggest public health fiasco in history," for The Telegraph. So thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Kulldorff.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure.
So first things first, we are mainly a political podcast, but we do want to get your thoughts on both the politics and the science behind COVID-19 and the lockdowns. But we first wanted to ask you about your experience doing science during this pandemic. So I've read and heard you in other interviews, and you've talked a lot about the censorship that you've experienced. So have you ever experienced this level of censorship and slander before in your career? And what effect do you think this has had on the process of science this year?
So I have not experienced that before. I'm shocked and stunned. I think science and academics is based on open discourse. And if you go back a year ago, I've been working with infectious disease outbreaks for 2 decades, but when I tried to make my voice heard a year ago, I was unable to do so in the United States, despite several attempts. I was able to publish in my in the major newspapers in my native Sweden, but not in the U.S. And I think that the slander attacks on those of us who eventually did manage to speak up, because now I can do it, now it's not a problem, has been disheartening, because not so much for me, because I can take it, but it has really difficult academic debate because there's many, many people who agree with the Great Barrington Declaration that the right approach is not universal lockdowns, but a focused protection strategy where we protect the high-risk older people. Many people in academics are afraid to speak up because of it, because of the what's happened to those of us who did speak up.
And do you feel that this has made pursuing the scientific method essentially impossible? Because one thing I've noticed is a lot of scientists basically dropping the scientific method and, for instance, adopting the alternative hypothesis instead of affirming the null hypothesis, for instance. I've noticed that a lot.
Yeah, and I think it has really damaged, I think, the trust in the scientific community and the trust in public health. And that's something that we in academics will have to spend many years, probably decades, to try to rebuild that trust. And it's the hard work ahead of us once the pandemic is over.
I'd like to go back to the beginning of the adoption of lockdown policies by the Western governments around about, well, this time last year. Now, the popularization of this was partly attributed to the perceived successes of the lockdown policy in China. Now, having looked into this, there seem to be a lot of scientists and policymakers and public officials who were very quick to endorse the lockdown policy that was inspired by the Chinese example. But it seems to me that they were doing so on the basis of very little independent study. So I'd like to ask you, is it your impression that they were endorsing this on the basis of a little independent study? And if so, why were so many so quick to endorse it?
So I think the answer to your first question is yes. A year ago, or in March 2020, there were no evidence that lockdowns would work, and now there is evidence, and they didn't work, and it went against all the pandemic preparedness plans that most governments, or at least most Western governments, had prepared, because we knew there were going to come a pandemic eventually. And it throws many of the basic principles of public health down out the window. So I was stunned. Why it happened, I'm just a simple scientist, and you probably understand politics better than I do, but I was just stunned that we would go down this route.
Well, it seemed to me that, because we in Britain, you might be aware, had a pre-established pandemic preparedness plan based on what you mentioned, which was focused protection of the elderly and the most at-risk groups. And that was discarded, apparently, over the course of one weekend, where the British government seemed to panic and abandon its prior established protocols. Do you think that the politicians in the West were basically bounced into this via what can only be described as an atmosphere of hysteria? And why was it that they were so many were so easily swayed, do you think?
I definitely think there was a big component of fear in the whole thing, and probably a fear that was sort of amplified both by media and later on by public health officials, which is actually one of the no-nos in public health. You should not exaggerate fear in a public health crisis. And I think there was problems also with public health messaging, because a key feature of this pandemic is that while anybody can get infected, there's more than a thousandfold difference in mortality risk between the oldest and the youngest. So that makes it sort of obvious that the right approach is to focus the protection on those who are at very high risk. And we didn't do a good job with that, because the lockdowns, people thinking that the lockdowns would protect everybody, which they didn't, obviously, now. We know that now. But that belief, that naive belief, meant that various focused protection strategies of those older people who are at high risk were never implemented. And that's what led to so many unnecessary deaths in this pandemic. It's impossible to avoid all deaths in the pandemic, but we had many more deaths than was necessary because of this lockdown strategy instead of focus protection or protecting the old. And not just excess deaths in COVID, but in addition to that, then you have all the collateral public health damage, where people didn't go to the hospital when they have cardiovascular disease problems, or people have missed cancer screenings, cancer treatments. So somebody who, and that's something that's maybe not so obvious in the short run, but in the long term, because somebody whose cancer was not detected in time and treated in time might now die 3 or 4 years from now instead of living another 15, 20 years. So, and of course, there's mental health, enormous mental health damage, and the school closures have not only affected education for kids, but also their physical and mental health and their social development. So this collateral public health damage is something that we can have live with and, to be honest, die with for many, many years to come. And that's very tragic.
Do you think that part of the reason why this has been such a fiasco, as you put it very well in your article, is because of this decision to refuse to admit the difference between a political decision and a scientific judgment? So usually the role of scientists in society is to provide advice, but the ultimate decision lies with the will of the people. And a political kind of process wherein economic and social costs and benefits are factored in. So do you think that perhaps part of the reason is just that there's been this conflation between science and politics during this pandemic?
There has certainly been such conflation. And obviously it is, it's not scientists, but politicians who will ultimately have to make decision together with the population, because we also have to trust the population in public health. It's based on the population trusting public health authorities and public health authorities, politicians trusting people, and we haven't had that during this pandemic, so that's very, very sad. But I also think that within the politicians, they have their perspectives as professionals, and I think the professionals dominate politics. For them, these lockdowns hasn't necessarily been so bad. They've been able to work from home and so on, and they have a garden in the house that they can sort of go outside when needed. But much of the lockdown harms has been, the burden has been on the working class. Because both in terms of COVID, because they are the essential workers that keeps the society going, working with food distribution and so on. So they are the ones who was hit the most in terms of the COVID being exposed. So what we essentially did, with the lockdowns, we protected young professionals, very low risk professionals who have very little risk from dying from this COVID-19 if they get infected. So we have protected them by having them work from home, etc. At the same time, older working class people in their 60s has been out working because they have to. We have to keep the society going, and they have to make a living. And we didn't protect the working class of the older members who often live in the multi-generational homes, for example, and so on. So what lockdowns, instead of protecting the high-risk older people while letting younger people live normal lives and keep society afloat, we basically went and protected the professional class or the laptop class who can work from home and who are at low risk. And we can see that actually succeeded. If we look at Los Angeles or Toronto and many other cities, but I have seen the data from those and a few more, we can see that in Toronto, in the very beginning, a year ago, there were about equal number of cases in the affluent and less affluent neighborhoods. But then when the lockdowns set in, they continue to increase in the less affluent neighborhoods, while in the more affluent neighborhoods, it plateaued. And mm-hmm. I think in Los Angeles, it's about a threefold difference between in mortality between the more affluent and the less affluent. So mm-hmm. this is sort of an evidence that, one, you can actually protect certain groups over other groups, and not 100%, because you always can have some mortality in all groups, but you can actually differentiate that. And we chose to do that based on who were the most affluent or less affluent, rather than do it based on who are at most risk and who are at less risk. Mm-hmm. And in this pandemic, the older people are at higher risk and the younger people are not. For older people, this is more dangerous than influenza, but for children, COVID-19 is much less risky than the annual influenza, which is already at low risk for children. So, mm-hmm. I think that's one of the basic principles of public health also, that public health is not only for certain members of society. In public health, we have to think about everybody in society equally, whether they are rich or poor, upper class, middle class, or working class, and so on. And that also goes on the global scale. The lockdowns have had devastating consequences in much of the developing world. Mm-hmm. So with the children starving to death or malnutrition, with tuberculosis cases increasing, and the list is unfortunately very, very long of the negative consequences of these lockdowns.
Do you think there is any way at all that these lockdowns had even just a little bit more benefit than the costs?
No, I don't think so, because I think mm-hmm. the lockdowns are... So lockdowns can be sort of effective in the short run. Mm-hmm. So if it had taken, let's say, a month or two to get a magic treatment to deal with this, or a vaccine within 1 or 2 months, then it might have been worth it. But... what lockdowns essentially does is, lockdowns is essentially a let it rip strategy with a little bit of a drag it out. Mm. And there's one reason for that. And then it's a year ago, we had to make sure that we didn't overburden the hospitals. So because everybody cannot get sick at the same time. So there was actually a rationale for it a year ago to do it for a few weeks in order to prevent everybody to be going to the hospital at the same time, sort of flatten the curve. But then it sort of morphed into a suppression, and that cannot be done. You can just sort of postpone the problem into the future, and that actually makes it harder for older people to protect themselves. So I think the lockdowns has been very bad in terms of COVID itself and mortality of COVID. Where we have sort of had a lockdowns is a dragged out at the rip strategy instead of a focused protection strategy who actually protects the people that are at high risk. But then if we add the collateral public health damage to this, then it's no question about the disaster that we put ourselves into.
To return to what you mentioned earlier, your native country, Sweden, which famously has followed a different path to the majority of the rest of the European countries. Can you talk a little bit about why that was, and what is it about, like, the Swedish system that made that response different? Or is it just a case that they were sticking to the evidence-tested protocols and everybody else abandoned them?
I think your last explanation is correct. And I think there was a fairly strong consensus among the infectious disease epidemiologists in Sweden that was the right thing to do, with only one person in opposition, I think, one infectious disease epidemiologist in opposition. So I think that helped. And now Sweden's strategy wasn't perfect. That's sort of very difficult, but they made the right decision to, for example, keep daycare and schools open during last year, during the height of the 2020 spring first wave. And that turned out very well, because among 1.8 million children ages 1 to 15 who were all in school or daycare, there were exactly zero deaths from COVID among this age group. There were only a few hospitalizations, and among their teachers, they actually had lower COVID risk than the average of other professions. So, and that's because children do not can be infected, but they are usually asymptomatic or very mildly symptomatic, and they don't they're not very good at spreading it to others. So that was clearly the right approach of Sweden at the time to keep those schools open, and that's very important for both children and society in general to have schools functioning and being open. So I think that was a very, very good decision that Sweden did. There was also a problem because Sweden did not do enough to protect the older population. And for example, there was major problems in the nursing homes in the Stockholm area. And I think that's one problem, I think, is the companies, the corporations who runs these nursing homes, they didn't take the necessary measures to, for example, reduce staff rotation and so on, and making sure that if a staff person was sick, that they would stay home, in other parts of Sweden, like in the northern part where I'm from, it worked better, and there's actually a big difference, despite having the same strategy, there's actually a big difference between different regions. So my home region in the north has only a third of the mortality rate by population as the Stockholm area.
So the question of like why decisions were made in the way that they are is a crucial one, because the news and media atmosphere we have of today, based around the constant unfolding minute-to-minute coverage of the 24-hour news channels, is meant to supposedly inform the public more about, you know, as news stories as they unfold. But when we get to questions that are often complex scientific and public health questions, has the 24-hour news cycle and the sort of frenetic minute-by-minute coverage, has it actually made those questions less clear to the public? And has it actually made the response to this pandemic worse by the coverage being so frenetic and sometimes over the top?
I think so. And at least in the US, I think some of the mainstream media has sort of a desire to instill fear, because maybe that increases the viewership. So for just a trivial example, whenever there's in the winter when we're getting some snow in the US, the media often plays it up and we're going to have a major snowstorm. And sometimes it is a major snowstorm, but sometimes it turns out just to be a few flurries. But the media likes to play it out because that increases their viewership, I think. So maybe that same tactic was used in the pandemic, which, of course, is much, much more detrimental. But also, if I want to do... one other thing is, I think, one thing that's good, though, I think, is these kind of more in-depth podcasts that you are doing and other people are doing, that actually allows for more more depth in the discussion. So I think that's a good thing that has that we have now. So I don't think in that sense it's all bad in terms of the media landscape. And I think so what you are doing with these kind of podcasts and what other people are doing, I think, is a good thing. The other thing is that as a personal reflection, when I have done interviews for the main media in different countries, I can sense a difference in the US and the UK versus many other countries. So in the US, when I do an interview, either the journalist is very positive and sort of clearly agrees with the general stance, then we have a very friendly and interesting and discussion. Then there's the other situation where the journalist is very hostile and trying to trip you up and use slander and those things and ad hominem attacks. So there's a very sort of very confrontational approach, because I think the media sort of has maybe some agenda that they're wanting pushing. They are either for you or against you. When I have done interviews with media in other countries, like for example Mexico or Chile or India or South Africa and so on, Argentina, the journalists, they ask very tough questions, very hard questions, but very fair and the right questions, because they really want to get the depth of things. So they are very tough journalists, but they are not trying to use, they're doing the science, they're not trying to use slander or ad hominem attacks. They're really trying to understand by asking the tough questions. And actually, those are the interviews, I think those type of interviews are very good, because it also forces me to really come up and motivate what I'm thinking. So I like those tough interviews, tough but fair interviews. But I haven't had many of those
in
the United
States. I think the media atmosphere in Britain is very similar, in that the media are almost all aligned with different political factions. And I, and my own reflection is that certainly the media in the United States filtered the story of the pandemic through mainly through the pro and anti-Trump lens. And that had, I think, disastrous consequences, certainly for the level of public debate. And I wanted to ask a follow-up on that, which is that we've seen scientists and public health officials over the last year essentially become elevated into becoming political figures. I'm thinking specifically of the role played by Dr. Anthony Fauci in the United States. He has clearly been, whether he wanted to or not, embraced by one political faction and rejected by another. And in your view, does that pose a risk for public health officialdom and public health policy going forward, when scientists get brought into and embraced by one faction of politics over another, and therefore you see one section of the population embracing whatever they say and the other section rejecting it likewise?
Yeah, I agree. It's an enormous danger for public health. Public health has to reach everybody in society, whether a person are rich or poor, left or right, authoritarian or libertarian, it doesn't matter. It has to reach everybody. So when some epidemiologist or public health scientist, when they play this game, and like every other tweet is for or against Trump and every other tweet is about the pandemic, you've already sort of disqualified yourself in the eyes of half the population. And you can't do that with public health. So as a public health scientist, I have sort of decided that I'm not going to do that. I'm going to talk with the media on the left and the right, irrespectively, because I want to reach everybody. My own political views are actually kind of insignificant in a pandemic like this, because it's my knowledge about infectious disease outbreaks, which I worked with for 2 decades, that's are relevant. So I will talk about the public health, and whether I'm on the left or right doesn't really matter. In that context, I need to reach everybody. And but what I can say is, though, among those of us, me and my colleagues, who are against the lockdowns and in favor of focused protections, there are the whole range of the political spectrum, from left to right. So our views on that, you can come to that view, whatever your political views are, that we have to do, we have to protect those who are most vulnerable, and we should not do all the damage that's caused by the collateral damage caused by the lockdowns.
Now, the big thing on the scene is the vaccines, of course. What do you think so far of the vaccination campaign? Do you think that it's going to help address, protect those focus groups that the Barrington Declaration really focuses on? Or do you feel like the vaccinations as well have been ill-targeted as the lockdowns have been?
It's different in different countries. So some countries have done better than others in using the vaccine supply that they have, mm-hmm. in terms of focusing it on protecting those who are at the very oldest, either by vaccinating the older people as well as vaccinating the caretakers like nursing home staff and so on. Mm-hmm. But of course, vaccines is a great tool for focused protection. And we have to make sure that we make the vaccine available to older people, including those who are sort of more on the margins of society and who might not have the initiative themselves to make go through a complex procedure to make an appointment on their computer, which is sort of what have happened in some parts of the U.S. that it's been very complicated to make an appointment. At the same time, one thing that worries me about vaccines is vaccine passports or vaccine mandates, because that goes against that's very, very bad for public health. So for two reasons. One is that if you put in mandates, like if you you require university students to have be vaccinated, or if you require vaccine passports to go to the pub or to go to a concert or travel abroad or so on, that puts a lot of pressure on younger people to get the vaccine, and they are at very low risk. So they're not the priority for us to vaccinate. At the same time, there are older people in India and Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Nigeria, and Pakistan, and many other countries for which there's not vaccines available. So to vaccinate young people with low risk when there are older people who can't get vaccinated, that leads to excess death. And I think that's immoral. And unethical, both within a country as well as in a global setting. The other reason is that public health, as I said, is based on trust. And if you try to coerce people into getting a vaccine, then you're going to reduce that trust. And the trust in vaccine has plummeted this year. And unfortunately, that doesn't only affect the trust in the COVID vaccine, it also affects the trust in vaccines in general, like childhood vaccines, like measles vaccine or polio vaccines and so on. So I've been working with vaccines for a couple of decades, and we have worked very hard to increase the confidence in vaccines among the population. I think we've been very successful with that. But there is a small group that call them who are so-called anti-vaxxers, who are skeptical about vaccines. But the damage that those have done who are proponents of vaccine passport, the damage that they, the pro-passport people, have done to vaccine confidence is much bigger than anything that these anti-vaxxers has done through many years. So I think it's very, very unfortunate that we have these people pushing vaccine passports. It's from a public health perspective, it's a very stupid thing to do. And it goes against, again, it goes against the principles of public health. But maybe I shouldn't be surprised, because it's usually the same people who are pushing vaccine passport that were pushing the lockdown. So maybe I shouldn't be surprised by it.
Yeah, it definitely comes from the same bucket. So the same premises undergird both. Both approaches. I guess if I could just ask one more question. I've read into the trials a little bit, and it does seem like the vaccine trials of the major vaccines that are being deployed in the, at least the Western world, have actually not enrolled a large amount of who would be deemed kind of the vulnerable groups, so the frail and the elderly. Do you think that, what do you think of the level of evidence currently for the effectiveness of vaccines for these vulnerable groups?
You're right. And if I had designed those clinical trials, I would have done it differently. Mm-hmm. The majority of people enrolled were adults, middle-aged adults. And they should have enrolled, in my view, primarily older people. Mm-hmm. One consequence of that is we don't know enough from the clinical trials about the safety in older population, which are the ones who need this the most. Another consequence is that when the trials came out, they were shown to be have efficacy for reducing or eliminating symptomatic disease, but the more important outcomes of hospitalizations and death, you couldn't say anything from those clinical trials because there were not enough of them. And that's because they enrolled younger people who don't die from COVID. So I think they were not designed the way they should have been designed, unfortunately. So I think, and that's a very astute observation that you're doing that most journalists do not do. So I really appreciate that. Having said that, the fact that they reduce symptomatic disease in middle-aged people makes it sort of we would expect it also reduces hospitalization and death, and we'll expect it to work in older people. And I think that has turned out to be the case when we look at observational data. If you go back to Sweden again, for example, Sweden has done a good job of vaccinating, being very firm on vaccinating older people, the high-risk groups. And the death count in Sweden has gone down a lot, while the actual case counts has not gone down as much. So it's still circulating, but the death count has gone down. And I think vaccinating the older people has sort of really helped with that. So this is a very important vaccine for older people to take. Even if there are, we don't know everything about the adverse reactions to it yet, because that takes time to find out. But in older people, those risks are much, much less than the risk of dying from COVID. So it's certainly it certainly has a good benefit-cost ratio for older people.
Yeah, and I suppose we'll get some more firm data also as the phase 4 trials in Israel wraps up. Okay, so I think that's all from me. Alex, did you have anything else?
No, that's all from me. Just to say thank you for your time today, Dr. Koldorf. It's been an interesting discussion, and thank you for the work you've been doing on this, keeping the scientific method of scientific inquiry alive in the public debate, because apparently a lot of people have given up on that.
Yeah, we can't allow that to happen. So thank you so much, Alex, and thank you so much, Leila. It's been a pleasure talking to you.